And away we go. Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy Tom Fairbanks. Tom, everybody's finding excuses to go home early today from work. And why? Because the Wildcats...
Well, they got to decorate their Easter eggs, don't they?
Yeah. The Wildcats play today at a few minutes past 4 o'clock on CBS. So a lot of people... going to leave work early, try to get home to see the start of the game. It is Thursday. It's March 28th, 2024. We're in our 14th year now of the Buckmaster radio program, coming to you from the Bustos Media Campus. Five radio stations now under one roof. This one's 1030 KVOI, The Voice. We're in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio, worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. Also, 13 full years of programs conveniently archived, a ton of content at buckmastershow.com for our telephone interviews. We'll be starting with a telephonic interview today on the live line, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Once a month, it's our pleasure to welcome our contributor on public health. I'm so proud of this team we've put together, 24 people that are really experts in their fields. Will Humble is the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association, certainly now more than 30 years, pushing actually about 35 years in public health, including more than two decades at the Arizona Department of Health Services, where he served in various capacities, including the agency director from 2009 to 2015. Will, how are you?
Good afternoon, Bill. Doing just fine. How about you?
Doing well. Now there is an official director, I guess. Did the legislature finally approve a director for the agency?
No, that's still a lawsuit that hasn't been resolved yet. So, you know, there was 13 of the agency directors that were nominated and sent to the Senate, but were not heard by the Senate, and there's a lawsuit about that that's going to end up in the state Supreme Court's going to end up deciding that. But there's other directors that were never sent to the Senate in the first place, and that resolution hasn't happened yet either, including the director of the state health department. So it's all up in the air still.
So who runs the show?
It's a person named Jennifer Cunico. I don't really know her that well. She was she had a job when I was in the agency as the director there, but it wasn't a job that I didn't really know her very well. I still don't, honestly.
Talk a little bit about flu season. How did it turn out this year? I know it's still underway, but is this what had been expected?
Pretty much, there was nothing unusual about it. It was an earlier than normal influenza season for us, but it wasn't particularly, you know, robust or anything. So now, having said that, there's people that died of it. I mean, you know, so it's tragic in that sense. But in terms of, you know, it was basically a typical influenza season, I'd say.
One of the positives, and there are very few that come out of the COVID-19 pandemic 4 years ago when it started, was a killing off of an entire branch of the flu family tree. I believe it's a B strain. Was this a big deal in the end?
Well, what was happening is, you know, so first of all, the influenza virus is, in some ways, it's like the COVID virus, where it changes itself over time to be able to infect more people. All viruses really want to do is make more copies of themselves. They want to reproduce. So in order to do that, you've got to change a little bit so that you have new hosts to infect. And that's what the influenza virus does. It mutates over time so that it can continue to infect the same people over and over again because it's changed a bit. Those strains end up having sort of a life cycle where they've run their course, and that B strain that you're talking about, the Yakamoto, I think it was called, was already in decline before the COVID-19 pandemic, and the masking and the social distancing that happened in 2020 and 2021 was enough to basically put it out of commission. And the FDA met earlier, a couple weeks ago, I think, and decided that they are recommending that that strain be dropped from the influenza vaccine that people will get, that'll be available in September and October. So we're moving from a quadrivalent or four antigen vaccine this year, the one that's just ending, to a trivalent vaccine for this upcoming year.
You know, mixing these vaccines is really, a lot of it is guesswork. It's kind of like a winemaker. You got to get it just right. And now we're going to go down from four to three strains. Maybe that will mean they'll have a better shot at it being effective. I don't know, but it's a real art to make this thing right.
Yeah, it's an art and a science. So one of the things they do is laboratory scientists and health departments around the world, not just in the U.S., but in, you know, South American stuff, and Australia, New Zealand, they look at the strains that are circulating in their communities. Their laboratory scientists then take that into the lab and figure out exactly what strain is going around. And then they use that information to predict. So it's more like an educated guess, predict what is going to happen in the upcoming year. So this decision by FDA and CDC is going to make their decision in a couple of months too. We'll look at what happened in our influenza season that's just ending. And they look at what happened during last summer for us, which is winter in the Southern Hemisphere, look at what was circulating there, and then figure out if there's something new that they, or not new, but sometimes new, but figure out what's the best blend for what they expect to happen. But there can always be a wild card. I mean, you know, something can happen in the Southern Hemisphere's winter, which is our summer, that can, and that's what kind of what happens sometimes. That's what happened with H1N1. Remember back in 2009,
yeah.
Is the Southern Hemisphere during their winter, which is our summer, came up with a new strain. And by then, it's too late to make the new vaccine because you need most of these are egg-based vaccines. So you need 6 months. So you have to have a lot of lead to grow the vaccine. So you need a lead time. And so what you hope is that during the Northern Hemisphere summer, you don't get a wild card virus from the Southern Hemisphere that makes the vaccine less effective.
Will Humble is with us. Will, Director of Marketing and Public Relations and the Executive Director for the Arizona Public Health Association. A lot of my contemporaries, that's a word, nice way of saying people around my age, are thinking of getting the booster before they do some traveling late this spring and summer. Many of us did get the shot in September and October. You are allowed to get the COVID booster if it's been 4 months. Is this pretty much the same? If you're going to get it now, is it pretty much what you got last fall, Will?
Oh, that, you know what, Bill? You stumped me.
Oh, good.
I think it's good to be honest.
Yeah.
I haven't kept up with that part of it. I think it's the same vaccine, but I don't want to say that definitively because, I just haven't read up on that.
I think I have the answer.
It's the same.
I think I have the answer to my own question, which is sometimes very helpful. The redesign that's being worked by, for sure, Moderna, they've saying the effectiveness of their new shot, which would be available in the fall, is even better than what we've been getting in the past. So I think what this booster is pretty much, if you're getting it now, what you got last fall. But it does give you apparently a little bit of extra protection if you're going to be doing some traveling, which a lot of people will this summer.
Yeah, so now I'll start asking you questions.
Okay. But about COVID, we did get a lot of funding. The state got money, COVID funds. What are we going to do? We're going to leave that money on the table, or is the governor going to use it to pay off and cancel some of the medical debt?
Yeah, so the governor found a clever way to leverage some of those federal COVID funds to relieve some medical debt. Now, there's some people out there who may have had, underinsured or uninsured who came up with bills that they were unable to pay that their insurance wouldn't cover. And sometimes these debt collectors can be pretty aggressive. And what ends up happening is, you know, the medical debt from a hospital or something gets sold to a debt collection agency for pennies on the dollar. And then those debt collection agencies go around and badger the patients.
Yeah.
And it can get stressed. And it's not just the money. It's being kind of badgered and stuff. It makes people nervous and they lose sleep and it's not good.
No.
So what the governor is doing isn't relieving individual people's debt, but rather buying up the debt that's been sold by hospitals, for example, to these debt collectors so that they receive pennies on the dollar for that debt relief. But in exchange, they don't go around badgering patients for, you know, some of those things that their health insurance plan wouldn't cover or whatever. So so by spending a few million dollars of federal funds, governor is going to be able to relieve more than $1 billion in debt. That's because, like I said, these agencies buy it for pennies on the dollar and then they're going to get paid back. But the good thing is that people will stop being harassed.
Yeah. I mean, you've had health issues and then you're getting harassed. That really, you know, that really boosts your anxiety level, doesn't it, Will?
Yeah. And you, like I said, you can't sleep, but it gives you, you know, you diverted, you pay less attention at work. It affects your mood. You might be in a bad mood with your spouse or your kids. I mean, it's a real, you know, it's bad. So anyway, I thought that was a clever use of those federal funds to, you know, to help people out and get a lot more debt relief than, you know, than you're spending. It's highly leveraged because of, you know, some of these hospitals already gave up on that debt and other people bought it. So,
all right. When we continue, Will, we'll get an update. What's going on health related, public health issues at the legislature when we continue on the Buckmaster Show this Thursday. But right now it's Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. If you'd like a beer with your lunch, that's available now. The enhancement, they do have the liquor license. It's being utilized up at Mona's Danish Bakery, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Breakfast, of course, their great signature breakfast. They open the door at 6:30, and maybe you'd like to celebrate something with a mimosa, champagne, and orange juice with your breakfast. Mona'sDanishBakery.com is their website. We'll be talking public health with Will Humble after we take our first break of the Buckmaster Thursday edition. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is finalizing a new 20-year plan for RTA board review and approval to seek public feedback on the draft plan. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit essentialpest.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Bill Buckmaster with you in the driver's seat on our live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Will Humble, the former director of the Arizona Department of Health, he now heads up the Arizona Public Health Association. I'm so envious of this trip that you're going to be taking to check out the solar eclipse, which is 2 weeks from today. You're going down to the Durango, Mexico area. That sounds really intriguing. I just looked up Durango, Mexico on the map. Looks like it's very close to Mazatlan.
Yeah, it's inland from Mazatlan. And it's like the altitude of Prescott. It's about 5,000 feet.
Nice.
Here's a couple interesting things about Durango, Mexico. You know all those John Wayne movies and stuff in the 70s and that?
Yeah.
Everyone thinks those were from Arizona. Most of those were filmed in Durango, Mexico.
Really?
Yeah. And it's also Pancho Villa's hometown. There's a museum for him there. There's some old mines you can go. There's some mine shafts you can visit, like you can do in Bisbee and that. And there's horseback rides. You can go to the old studios when Westerns were popular. They still make some movies down there.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's a lot more to it than just an eclipse. So,
you know,
I wonder
if they made that Treasure of the Sierra Madre, the famous movie with Humphrey Bogart. I wonder if that was done at Durango. It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, no, I don't know. You know, all those Clint Eastwood Westerns were too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a big movie mecca.
So you fly into Mazatlan?
No, we decided to fly to, well, first we have to go to Dallas. And then down to Durango. Otherwise, you got to fly direct to Mazatlan, but then you got to rent a car.
But you can get a flight then direct from Dallas to Durango?
Yeah.
Wow. Very cool. What's going on at the legislature in your neck of the woods, the areas that you follow, public health?
Yeah, the two areas I've been focusing on this year have been to improve the laws around regulating assisted living and skilled nursing facilities in Arizona so that we do a better job protecting seniors who are living in those kinds of care facilities. Right. For many years, we haven't been doing a very good job. So there's some laws we need to change around that. And then I've been focusing on improvement of laws to help care for people with a serious mental illness. So we can talk about some of those if you want to for
sure.
A bit.
Yeah.
But those have been the two main areas that I've been spending most time on this year.
Begin with the nursing area and skilled and assisted living.
Yeah, so we've talked on this show before about what happened during the prior administration when the health department, who is responsible for regulating assisted living and skilled nursing facilities, was basically looking the other way. And when people were filing complaints about care for their loved ones in skilled nursing and assisted living, the health department either didn't investigate those complaints at all, or when they got caught by not investigating them, they reclassified the high-risk complaints like medication errors, pressure ulcers and stuff as low-risk, cooking the books, making it look like they've been doing their job when they, in fact, had not been. Now, that you can't legislate good performance by an executive agency, but what you can do is, and the leadership has been changed since then, but what you can do is to give that agency more and better tools for enforcing the regulations that are on the books. And so one of the bills that I've been pressing for and is actually having good success would give more enforcement authority to the state health department so that when facilities are doing a bad job, not caring for people like they're supposed to, that the state health department would have more enforcement authority so that they would take those deficiencies more seriously and make it a priority to fix them. So like right now, and this was the fact when I was the agency director, one of the big things that hamstrung us with these facilities was the places that were doing bad would just keep doing bad. And we could issue $500 fines per day, but to them that's lunch money, you know. And it wasn't enough to make them like take it seriously. And this bill by Representative Dunn, which is in its last lap, I think it's going to pass, would move that enforcement authority to $1,000 a day, which isn't a huge, that's still not very much, but it also would say per person per day. So if you have more, but the way it is now, this $500 a day, no matter how many people were harmed. This way it could be $1,000 per day per person that was either neglected or abused. So a lot more teeth in the law in that respect. Now, having said that, if this passes, you know, and the governor signs it, doesn't mean that it's going to have an immediate effect. What you really need is to have the state health department, you know, start hiring a lot more people, doing a lot more training, retaining them. And that is underway. Things are getting better. But anyone who's run a business knows that, you know, one of the biggest, or government agency, one of your biggest challenges is hiring and recruiting and retaining and training talented staff. It doesn't happen overnight. They're in the process of fixing things. We're not there yet, but I am pleased that they are actually making progress. And one of the keys is, you know, when you see an agency start to hide its problems, that's a big, big problem. That mm-hmm. is what leads to really substandard care. And when I was in that agency role, I was like, look, I want to make sure everybody knows that it's okay to make mistakes, that it's okay if we're, you know, doing something wrong. Let's identify it and fix it. If you sweep it under the rug, what that means is you're denying that the problem exists and you're not going to take efforts to fix it. And that did happen for many years in that agency after I left. But I do see that it has, that culture has been changing over the last several months.
Anything else? There was one other item you said you were keeping an eye on at the legislature.
Well, for care for people with serious mental illness, one of the things that we have this an issue here is in our state, and it's been this way for a long time, is people with a serious mental illness, you know, need secure care where they can take their meds and get on a good track so that they can be on their path of recovery. And in Arizona, we have really restrictive environments like, you know, inpatient hospital facilities like the state hospital and up at Valleywise here in the Valley. And then we have behavioral health group homes, which are okay for some people, but we're missing the piece of the care that we need where it's a secure residential facility. So we need some places where people with a serious mental illness can go to get their court ordered treatment for medications where they can't just get up and leave because they want to, until they're stabilized and on a good path. And we just don't have that part of the care continuum. And so I've been, not just me, but a few of us who know about this big gap in the care continuum have been really pressing the state to invest in the kinds of facilities that allow people to get on a path to recovery and have the kind of security that they need before their meds kick in or before their psychiatrist finds the right combination of meds that work.
I find this issue that about gas stoves very interesting. Lawmakers are thinking of letting the voters decide whether you will be able to own a gas stove in Arizona. I mean, is this some kind of a health issue?
I don't understand that. No, no one's taking anyone's gas stove. I mean, there are people that are encouraging people to not, when they're building a new house, to not put gas in, to use induction stoves because there's less pollution and they don't need the venting and all that stuff. But like, I don't know of anybody who's no one, I don't think, has the authority to take away someone's gas stove. So I don't know if that'll we'll see if that gets on the ballot or not. I don't know. It seems like a trivial matter to me because it's much ado about nothing.
And quickly about hemp, there was an item about hemp in head shops.
Yeah. So, you know, we have the Arizona Medical Marijuana Act, and we have the retail law that followed up. Both voters approved both of those. And now you have, you know, a separate law that allows farmers to make hemp, which is the cannabis plant, but it's not the, you know, the kind of plant that creates the THC in high concentrations. But what some clever folks are doing is taking the hemp plant and then making what's called Delta H THC, which gets people high, and then saying, well, this, you don't need to sell this in a dispensary. You could just sell it in head shops, which that's what I used to call them. Now they're called smoke shops. But but places that don't have a dispensary license are now selling this stuff that gets kids, anyone high. The problem is with adolescents, I think. The attorney general last week said, hey, wait a minute. This, even though this Delta H THC was made with hemp and not regular marijuana, it's still intoxicating and you can't sell it in these head shops. You've got to sell it in a regulated dispensary.
All right. Will, we're going to have to leave it right there. We'll talk to you next month. Have a great trip. Hope you see the solar eclipse. Going to be great. Thanks.
Yeah, better not be cloudy.
I know. Could be at that altitude. But who knows? Have a great trip. That'll do it. The midway point of the Buckmaster Show. Take a break.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. And your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show and the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. Our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. I want to talk a little bit about Green Things. We're having just such a, I know I've been saying this almost every day about how pleased I am with the weather. You know, not too hot, not too cold, enough moisture. Well, the plants over at Green Things, loving it. 13-acre site, 3384 East River Road. So this is the perfect time of year to do some spring gardening. They're open daily. They're in their 53rd year of business, greenthingsaz.com. While you're there, how about some beautiful pottery to go with your plants? I love the pottery over at Green Things. Talaveras from Mexico. They've got pottery for all the way from Crete. Great pots from Vietnam and Asia, a lot of stuff at Zocalo Village. Their website is zocalovillage.com. Wow, I am so pleased to have a team of contributors. Will Humble is our contributor on public health. Our contributor on agriculture is Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, and he is with me in studio. Just so pleased that there's two dozen experts that we can call upon here on the Buckmaster Show. And these are people that just are, I mean, Jeff has been so involved with agriculture, really, since he left his home state of Oklahoma. But even as a kid growing up in Oklahoma, Jeff, you were working on the farm, weren't you?
Yes, I was, Bill. I was... My parents weren't farmers, but came from a farming background in our family. But I started working on farms when I was 12 years old, actually in southern Kansas, where we were living there at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff Silvertooth is a professor and extension specialist in agronomy and soil science at the University of Arizona Department of Environmental Science. He served on the University of Arizona faculty and worked statewide since 1987. Professor Silvertooth has been recognized as a fellow for both the American Society of Agronomy, the ASA, and the Soil Science Society of America. Jeff, always a pleasure to see you, sir.
Likewise. Thank you, Bill.
And it seems like 30 days or however long it's been, it might have been a little longer this time with you. So much is going on. It's almost like this water thing. It's changing every day, but we are hearing more and more about the states from the Colorado River's upper and lower basins putting out their proposals for curbing the river water use. Those proposals are pretty much all different, but everybody in the end are going to have to be on the same page.
That's right.
I hope I summarized that well.
Yeah, it's a good outline. It is. Uh-huh. The negotiations have been going on because the current guidelines that were, we call them 2007 interim guidelines that were agreed upon in 2006, 2007, for how we manage shortages on the Colorado River is what this is all about, really. And they expire in 2026, and so new guidelines will come into play in 2026. So they call this the reconsultation process for the whole base and all seven states in the United States side and two states in Mexico. So these states each have delegations. Our state included, Arizona has a delegation involved in negotiations, and this has been ongoing for several years, as you can appreciate. That's been difficult, and it's been compounded by the fact that we're now at least 23 years into a severe drought, and we've really hit shortages that a lot of folks in 2006, 2007 really never thought, you know, would be possible. But here we are, and the reality for us today is we've been dealing with that now for 3 years. So it's really intensified the nature of these discussions, these negotiations among the basin states. What you have now is they were supposed to come together to the feds, to the Bureau of Reclamation within the Department of Interior in early March, with a common proposal. And it seemed like for a while they were going to be able to do that, but
they didn't meet the deadline.
No, there's too much contention between
upper. They pushed this can down the road.
Well, you know, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. There's so much contention between upper basin and lower basin. Upper basin would be the states above Lake Powell, you know, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And lower basin states would be Nevada, California, Arizona. And then, of course, Mexico gets brought into that loop as well. So there's this huge difference among the lower basin and upper basin positions on this. So two proposals were submitted on the 6th of March this year, and the Bureau has both proposals under review. They say they want to come back and work with the states and try to come up with some continue the negotiations and come up with something that's common for everyone, maybe late summer.
They keep talking about shared sacrifice. What does that mean?
Well, it depends who you talk to. There's some folk. Well, according to the 2007 interim guidelines, and according to the what we call the law of the river, you know, that amalgam of laws, contracts, treaties, agreements that have been developed over the course of the past 120 years, the base of that is with the Colorado River Compact, and the allocations of water come out of that compact. What was further clarified in several court cases, particularly the Arizona versus California case that went through the Supreme Court in 1963. They basically laid out, said, here's how much water each state gets on this Colorado River division. And within the states, then you divide that up within the states as appropriate based on law of the river. And now some folks are coming back and saying, well, wait a minute, we need to redo this whole set of laws and change these appropriations and change how we share the shortages. And some folks say one school of thought, follow the law that tells you how to deal with the shortages, which we've been doing, and you need to continue to do so within the framework of this law of the river. Others are saying, no, we need to redo this whole thing. We need everyone on the basin needs to share equally.
Because the law of the river is 100 years old.
Collectively. Yeah. It's a body of law, body of rules, contracts, treaties that have been brought together to make this amalgam that we call collectively the law of the river in a broad sense. But yeah, so there's a lot of that's really at the heart of this is how do we deal with the law of the river as it is today, work up the guidelines for these shortages within the context of that law of the river, or do you start changing the whole background framework? The concern, of course, is if someone breaks in and wants to do that, it goes to court. These things will be settled out of court. You really don't want courts deciding this. You really want people that have skin in the game out here in the West that are deciding it. You don't want to.
Otherwise, you could have court action from each of these states.
It could be a cascading series of events. And the last one that I mentioned, the 63 case at the Supreme Court, that was started in 1952. These things aren't easy to work out, and the courts have a difficult time because they're not involved in it directly. The Bureau has a hard enough time, and they want the states to solve it, but there's where we are. We're at this great impasse.
What about the Native people? What about the First Nations people, the Indians?
There are numerous tribes that have direct water rights on the Colorado River. As a matter of fact, the strongest, we have priority rights we call perfected priority rights. Perfected priority rights, I think is the way it's put, PPRs. And those are actually established by more or less the first come, first serve. We say first in time, first in right. The first, right at the top of the list, is the Colorado River Indian tribes. They're in Parker Valley, Arizona, right across from Palo Verde Valley, California. They have those perfected water rights that go back to the very beginning. So they, Imperial Valley, Palo Verde, and the Yuma Valley, have these number one top priorities. They're the last ones to lose water on the river because they were the first ones to perfect those rights. Perfecting those rights mean they had to go through the states and the federal government to say, we have these claims of water. We have this claim of water on the river. And everyone else has come back behind that more or less in time. The Colorado River Indian tribes, CRIT we refer to them as they have these top priority rights. Other tribes in the state that are getting some of this water, well, I should back that up. I think, too, several of the other tribes that are right on the main stem of the Colorado River have high priority water rights, the Keshans, the Chemehuevis, et cetera, the Aviqua Amis there in Mojave Valley, et cetera. There's a number of them on the Colorado River. Then those in central Arizona, like Gila River Indian Community, GRIC, and Ok-Chin, both in central Arizona, primarily Pinal County, they have lower priority water rights. And so some of those tribes are coming in now, like Grick came out just recently and said, well, we're a part of the lower basin proposal, but we reject it. We're not part of it. we're going to come out with our own proposal, which they're apparently working on right now. That's going to be interesting to see, because they have water rights. They do have water rights, they're just lower priority. Exactly what they want to angle on this, I'm not sure, but it's an interesting position to take right now.
All right, we're going to pause with Jeff Silvertooth talking water here on the Buckmaster Show. We'll be right back after we take a quick break.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation improvements in the region, averaging more than $100 million in tax revenue each year. The RTA is preparing a new 20-year plan for public review prior to a May 2025 election. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. It's not only a perfect time to do some gardening, it's also a great time to go over to Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. A great getaway, about a three-hour drive. Perfect time of year with the greening up of the Gila National Wilderness. Just hanging out in historic, a lot of historic architecture, Victorian architecture in Silver City. Three-hour drive, approximately. Find out more on their website, southwestnewmexico.org. We continue now with our monthly conversation with our agronomist, our contributor on agriculture, Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, Dr. Silvertooth, professor and extension specialist in agronomy and soil science at the University of Arizona. Jeff, I'm going to ask you to slip on your headset here because we do have a question on our live line, and our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Okay, caller, go ahead. You're with Dr. Silvertooth.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. I think I have a pretty simple question. When it comes to distributing the water in times of shortage, why can't it be a simple prorate of whatever the existing laws are, which they are what they are, and you simply say, well, Lake Mead's at 50%, everybody gets 50% of their allocation and that's that. In other words, it seemed like it would save at least some of this endless bickering.
Okay, thank you, sir.
That's a good question. Very good question. And I think the simple answer to that would be based on that law of the river, those prior perfected water rights, those prior perfected rights, PPRs. And folks that say, well, we have higher priority rights than, say, just say you and I are representing two different states. I have high priority rights and you have a lower priority right. One person might say, well, you might say, well, let's just all share this burden equally. And then I might be able to come back and argue, well, wait a minute, you've got to share your part first before me because of our prior perfected water rights and the way the law of the river was structured collectively over time. You might say then, well, then that's why some people would argue exactly right there is why we need to go back and restructure this law and this foundational base upon which we make these kinds of decisions and appropriations for the cuts. So it's a good question, and that's exactly, really, it's driving into the heart of what these discussions are about right now.
All right, let's move on from water. The Arizona Republic has an opinion piece, an op-ed piece, Why Arizona Lost the Little Guy in Commercial Farming Long Ago. Have we lost the ma-and-pa farmer in Arizona?
No.
We have not.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. That's a good article. That's Joanna Allhands. Uh-huh. That's a Republic article. Mm-hmm. She does a good job. And actually, I'm impressed by the fact that she tells the story in agriculture very accurately, and she's not an Aggie, so per se, so to speak.
That's her beat, though, agriculture. For
she
the
works
Republic.
In that arena
yeah,
quite
that
a lot.
Arena,
yeah. She's good.
Yeah.
And she makes the effort to get out and find out what's going on. And it's not a hard question. I think, as I recall, it's like the last part of her article, the last sentences, is the public debate is focused on two things. It's kind of a doomsday mm-hmm. kind of approach. Oh, we're losing all these little farms and big mm-hmm. corporate farms are running out, blah, blah. You know, it's hyperbole. And the second is there's some kind of fantasy about some nostalgic view of the past, you know, kind of, I call it the Green Acres syndrome. You know, people have this nostalgic view of farming and they want to, you know, have a romantic view of it. Mm-hmm. And she's exactly right. The reality of it is that all the farms I deal with in Arizona, not every individual farm, but I've been here for almost 40 years and working around the state. They're family-based operations.
Now, they go back generations in many cases.
Most,
right?
A lot of them in Arizona, you go back a five-generation, four-generation farm. That's an old one here.
Wow.
You know? And everybody is. I mean, that's the way they all are. Now, they might have large companies now, but it's because of the market and the economics that really drive this to a large extent that make it very difficult for the small person to exist, the little farm. But there are family people out there running these farms all over the place, all over the farms and ranches. And that's not just here, but it's really everywhere. So she did a good job at that article. I commend her for that.
In Cochise County, farmers have won a reprieve to secure groundwater use in the new management area.
Well, yeah, right. We had an active management area was voted in by the Douglas area. There were two of them and up for the last election, what, in 22? And one was the Wilcox Basin, Sulphur Springs Valley, and the one was around Douglas. Now, the Douglas one passed. The voters there ratified that and passed it. So based on the 1980 Groundwater Management Act, that's an active management area, and there are certain specifications that come along with that very clearly. And one of them is if you have these water rights already, what they call grandfathered water rights, I think it's more than 35 gallons per minute, the well capacities in excess of that, then you have to go back in and make sure you've, you know, submitted those and get them on the register on a point of record that you're going to maintain those rights. What happened down there in Douglas when that went through for election or for a vote 2 years ago, I thought at the time it was very, very poorly communicated. I was working down there with people and they didn't know what was going on. They didn't even, a lot of people didn't even know there was an election up on this issue. Farmers and ranchers, people mm-hmm. that would be most likely to.
It was a Cochise County election, but most people didn't know about it.
Yeah, the Cochise County folks didn't know. And they didn't know what, and there was a ton of misinformation going on. And of course, as an educator with the U of A, I was looking at this like, man, this is a mess.
Yeah.
And so I was surprised to see it pass. One up in Wilcox did not pass, kind of for the same reasons, but there was enough misinformation that took people away from it. And now they're coming back, and a lot of folks in the past couple of years have been saying, what's going on? And they said, well, you don't come in and you don't register your grandfather water rights by this certain date, you're going to lose your water mm-hmm. by law, mm-hmm. which is right. And so they've been scrambling, saying, well, what? They're just trying to figure this out. So many people, I mean, gosh, it's amazing the number of people that aren't on the internet right now. And you don't get on them. They don't read email. You know, they're not on all this. And so that so much stuff has come out of our systems that kind of count on that. And that's a lot of folks are saying, I didn't know what the heck was going on.
You know, we assume everybody is on getting the email and you want, why did I not get a response immediately? Well, some of these people don't even look at email.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. And so that's what the reprieve and time is about. It's a short window, but it gives them some extra time. And so that's actually good for them down there.
All right. Interesting article up in my old neck of the woods where I worked in the 1970s in the media in Las Vegas, the Review Journal up there, the newspaper, Aging Hoover Dam. Boy, we don't think about this, Jeff Silvertooth, but that dam goes back to the Depression era, the 1930s, and maintenance has not been keeping up. You don't want cracks developing in Hoover Dam. So it looks like they may get about $45 million for some maintenance. The government has just not kept up with it.
Infrastructure up and down the river is critical. Of course, that's a big one, you know. Hoover Dam and also Boulder Dam, or not, that used to be Boulder Dam.
Yeah, it used to be Boulder Dam there by Boulder Lake, City.
Yeah, yeah. Lake Powell.
Yeah.
Up there in Lake Powell. Both those are critical infrastructure, but there's infrastructure up and down that river. I think there's five or six dams below on the lower Colorado River, below, including Lake Mead, including Hoover Dam, mm-hmm. all the way down to the border. Mm-hmm. All that infrastructure needs maintenance all the time. I work with districts that are out there on the river, and they are constantly. Just talked to a water director this morning with the Yuma County Water Users Association. They're doing maintenance on their transfers, canals over heading into Mexico. So yeah, maintaining the dam is critical. I mean, it has been maintained. It's not like it's been, you know, mothballed or anything, but it just takes a lot to do so.
Are they at all dependent, because the snowpack now is at normal in the High Sierra, which is great news. This is news from Fresno, California. Mm-hmm. The snowpack's at normal, and I wonder if that has any impact on your area. You were just talking about the Imperial Valley and Yuma area. Are they at all dependent on that, or no?
No.
That's more Colorado River for the Yuma. They're not worried. They're not really about the snowpack is not a big issue.
Well, the snowpack's a big issue, okay. But in a different mountain range.
Yeah.
A different part of the country, in the watershed that affects the Colorado River, which would be Colorado, Wyoming. That's where a lot of that river water comes from.
Mm-hmm.
The Sierra Nevada, that mostly will affect
San Joaquin Valley.
Yeah,
right?
That will mostly affect California.
Yeah, well, that's good news that they're finally.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that they've had really a lot of snow. It started off the year, hardly anything. Everybody's going, oh no, going to be a bad snow year. It's turned out to be pretty much snowpack at normal.
And we have a good snowpack in the Rockies, too, as I understand
we do?
Right now. Right.
Good.
That would affect the Colorado River for this year.
All right, Jeff Silvertooth, it's always a pleasure to see you and be well, okay?
Thank you, Bill. Likewise, thank you.
Jeff Silvertooth from the University of Arizona and our contributor on agriculture here on the Buckmaster Show. All right, a lot of people will be finding excuses to get off work early today, Jeff. They'll want to get home and see the Arizona Wildcats.
Sure, good thing to do.
Yeah, a little after 4 o'clock. Good luck to our homegrown basketball team, the U of A, in action against the Clemson Tigers. Okay, on behalf of Tom Fairbanks, engineering and producing the show, and Professor Silvertooth, I'm Bill Buckmaster. Hope everybody is well and have a great day.